From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I'm Alan Dershowitz, and in my new book, The Case for Israel, I try to make the progressive case for a two-state solution, and I insist that when the Palestinian leadership really wants a Palestinian state more than they want to see the end of the Jewish state of Israel, the century-long conflict, which could have been resolved long ago, will finally be resolved.
Hi, I'm Norm Finkelstein. I read Alan Dershowitz's book twice. I carefully checked the sources, and it's my impression that the book does raise serious questions about his academic integrity, his intellectual honesty, and raises serious questions about whether he's even qualified to teach at Harvard University.
Well, this
today,
is going to be a
debate on the case. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush returned to the United Nations yesterday for the first time since the U.S. invaded Iraq without U.N. backing. This time he called for international assistance in the reconstruction of Iraq and to defend Washington's Iraq policy. On Iraq, Bush rejected proposals by France and Germany for power to be quickly transferred from the occupying U.S. and British forces back to the Iraqi people. Bush said the transfer must be, quote, neither hurried nor delayed. Bush also defended the invasion, saying Iraq's former dictator will never again use weapons of mass destruction. A Washington Post analysis found Bush's address left many unanswered questions, including how quickly would the United States grant sovereignty to the Iraqis? Would the administration grant any decision-making role to the United Nations? Or does the administration simply want assistance without giving up much in return? The Bush administration's policy of preemptive attack came under criticism from both Secretary General Kofi Annan and French President Jacques Chirac. Chirac said, quote, "The United Nations has just weathered one of its most serious trials in its history. Respect for the UN Charter, the use of force were at the heart of the debate. The war, which was started without the authorization of the Security Council, has shaken the multilateral system." Annan added on preemptive attacks, quote, "My concern is that if it were to be adopted, it would set precedents that resulted in a proliferation of the unilateral and lawless use of force with or without justification." Although Annan did not specifically refer to the United States, the New York Times reports he gave the impression that he believed Washington is endangering world peace with its foreign policies. The Washington Post reported Annan and Chirac's addresses received enthusiastic reaction, while Bush received tepid, almost perfunctory applause for his presentation. A lead editorial in the Washington Post was headlined, "A Failed Speech." Slate.com headlined their coverage, "Bush to the World, Drop Dead." Analysts predict support from the international community will be far less than Washington hoped. One diplomat told the New York Times, quote, "The situation in Iraq is getting more difficult every day, and so is the atmosphere at the United Nations." A federal appeals court yesterday ruled California's recall vote can go ahead as originally planned on October 7th, reversing another court order that would have delayed the election until March. The American Civil Liberties Union, which called for the delay because some voting districts will still be using faulty voting machines, announced it would not appeal yesterday's decision. The court unanimously ruled that federal courts, quote, cannot lightly interfere with state elections. In addition, the court noted that hundreds of thousands of Californians had already voted by absentee ballot. Meanwhile, Republican legislator Dara Lisa, who bankrolled the recall, said he would urge Californians to vote to keep Governor Gray Davis in office if both Republican frontrunner State Senator Tom McClintock and Arnold Schwarzenegger remain in the race. Issa said the two Republicans would split the GOP vote and give the election to Democrat Cruz Bustamante, who Issa described as worse than Davis. For the second time this month, the U.S. military has arrested one of its own at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, where it's holding over 600 detainees captured in Afghanistan and elsewhere. The Pentagon announced yesterday senior Air Force Airman Ahmad al-Halabi faces 32 criminal charges related to spying. Although Halal Habi, who worked as a translator, is being charged with giving classified information from the prison to Syria. On September 10th, Army Chaplain James Yee was arrested, but charges have not yet been filed. Iraq's U.S.-appointed governing council yesterday banned the Arab satellite television stations Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya from covering the council's news conferences and entering government ministries for 2 weeks. The council said the stations had committed irresponsible activities that threaten the country's, quote, democracy and stability. In other Iraq news, two commuter buses in Iraq were bombed today, killing a 17-year-old and injuring at least 12. CNN reports the bombs were intended for U.S. military vehicles. Meanwhile, the Associated Press is protesting the treatment of one of its photographers in Iraq after U.S. soldiers detained the journalist and his driver for 3 hours in 110-degree heat. They were handcuffed and denied water and use of a telephone. In other news, award-winning Los Angeles Times foreign correspondent Mark Feinman died Monday at the age of 51 after suffering a heart attack yesterday in Baghdad, where he was working. Out of Nowhere by saxophonist Frank Lowe with drummer Philip Wilson. Frank Lowe died Friday at the age of 60 in New York. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A 15-year-old unarmed Palestinian boy was killed and 14 Palestinians wounded when Palestinian militants and Israeli forces clashed in the southern Gaza Strip today. 20 Israeli tanks and bulldozers entered the Rafah refugee camp shortly after midnight, after 5 mortar shells were fired at a block of Israeli settlements in the Gaza Strip. No injuries or damage was reported. Meanwhile, Israeli Foreign Minister Silvan Shalom is scheduled to meet U.S. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice and Secretary of State General Colin Powell today to discuss the U.S. position on the route of the so-called security fence in the West Bank. Prior to the meetings, Shalom said during an interview on the fence that Israel should, quote, do everything to defend as many West Bank settlers as possible, and said the purpose of the fence is to defend Israeli citizens. Meanwhile, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting the Israeli government spends at least $560 million a year on subsidies, infrastructure, and education for 220,000 Jewish settlers living in the West Bank and Gaza. The figure does not include military spending in those areas. Haaretz says Israel has spent at least $10.1 billion on the settlements since capturing the West Bank and Gaza in 1967. Successive Israeli governments have refused to disclose how much they spend on settlements. Haaretz says it compiled the figure after 3 months of research, including interviews with dozens of government officials and experts. And yesterday, President Bush told the 58th session of the United Nations General Assembly, quote, the Palestinian cause is betrayed by leaders who cling to power by feeding old hatreds and destroying the good work of others. This comes days after the UN voted 133-4 to condemn Israel's decision to, quote, remove Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. The United States, Israel, the Marshall Islands, and Micronesia voted against the measure. Well, today we're going to have a very interesting debate on a new book called The Case for Israel. It's by Alan Dershowitz, who is one of the nation's foremost appellate lawyers, Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. His articles are published in the New York Times and other publications. His books include Chutzpah, The Vanishing American Jew, Why Terrorism Works, Shouting Fire, and America Declares Independence. We're also joined by Professor Norman Finkelstein. He is author of four books, including The Holocaust Industry, Reflections on the Exploitation of Jewish Suffering. His writings have appeared in prestigious journals like the London Review of Books, the Index on Censorship, the Journal of Palestine Studies, the New Left Review, the Christian Science Monitor, and others. He is also author of Image and Reality of the Israel-Palestine Conflict. His latest book is called The Holocaust Industry. Today, a debate. We're going to begin with Professor Alan Dershowitz. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much for having me.
And why don't we start with you laying out the thesis of your latest book, The Case for Israel.
Well, I wanted to write a progressive liberal case for the two-state solution, and the two-state solution which I think that most Israelis favor and have favored for a long time. I dedicate the book to Professor Aaron Barak, who is the president of the Israeli Supreme Court, and for a reason, because I argue in the book that no country in history faced with comparable threats, both external and internal, has ever tried so hard to comply with the rule of law. I compare Israel favorably to the United States. It's in this the kind of rough interrogation text. The only country in modern history in the Six-Day War and the more than 1,600 shells lobbed into of Beirut and in the Second World War, bombs did in Iraq, of which I am very critical. But, and so, myself, I oppose, in my view, a terrible mistake in 60s. I actually consulted with Justice Resolution, which presuppose, and today I think to make some unilateral change, small ones, end the settlements. In fact, my peace proposal is that Israel would have a schedule for ending the settlements. That is a schedule for saying on so-and-so day the settlement ends, conditioned on best efforts by the Palestinians to end terrorism. That would create an incentive to ending terrorist acts. By the way, you never condition anything on the end of terrorism because that gives the terrorists a veto. What you condition it is on making good faith efforts. And if we can get Israel to end the settlements and the occupation and the Palestinian leadership to stop using terrorism as a tactic, I think finally something that could have happened in 1917, a two-state solution, in 1937 when the Peel Commission recommended a non-contiguous Jewish homeland and the Israelis accepted it and the Arabs rejected it, in 1947 when the UN allocated that portion of Palestine that had a majority of Jews in it to a Jewish state and the portion of Palestine that had a Palestinian majority in it to an Arab state, we could have had a two-state solution. We could have had a two-state solution in 2000 and 2001 when Ehud Barak and President Clinton offered, to be sure, a non-contiguous state on 90-something percent of the West Bank and 100% of the Gaza with its capital in Jerusalem with a $35 billion refugee package. And when Arafat responded by violence instead of coming back to the table and saying, well, maybe we'll negotiate for a little bit more. So the two-state solution is inevitable. It's going to happen. The only question is how long it takes to happen. And my hope is that we can have a reasonable, serious debate about the future, about the rights and wrongs. I think there are rights and wrongs on both sides. But I'm nervous because I heard from my debating partner in the beginning what sounded like it was going to be simply an ad hominem attack on me as whether I'm qualified to teach at Harvard. I would hope we could elevate the discussion and keep it on the merits. I won't attack Mr. Finkelstein on his merits of his position. Let people read his book and judge for themselves. And if he would refrain from personal attacks on me and let people judge the book on its merits, I think we can move the ball forward and have a reasonable, serious debate. I think it'd be interesting to know where we agree, where we disagree, what facts we share in common, what facts we have different views on, and whether they're empirical and could be subjected to reasonable resolution, where we have moral disagreements. I really think that in the end, today you read the news about Israel, there's other good news. There's in the works, according to the New York Times, a prisoner exchange between Hezbollah and Israel, in which Israel would get back one person, a civilian who was captured by Hezbollah in exchange for Israel giving back 400 or so prisoners. There's movement forward. Let's not destroy that movement forward by getting involved in meaningless ad hominem discussion. Let's see if we can elevate the debate and see if we can really move forward to the two-state solution that I think virtually everybody in the world today wants.
Professor Alan Dershowitz, author of The Case for Israel. Norman Finkelstein, your response.
Well, I appreciate Alan Dershowitz's seriousness, at least in these remarks. I have no intention whatsoever of getting involved in an ad hominem debate with Mr. Dershowitz. I'm interested in the facts. I was asked to come in and discuss his new book. I went home, purchased one copy. In fact, I purchased two copies. I read the book very carefully. I did what someone serious does with a book. I read the text. I went through the footnotes. I went through it very carefully. And there's only one conclusion one can reach, having read the book. And this is a scholarly judgment. It's not an ad hominem attack. Mr. Dershowitz has concocted a fraud. In fact, Mr. Dershowitz has concocted a fraud which, amazingly, in large parts, he plagiarized from another fraud. Now, I found that pretty shocking. I found it shocking coming from a Harvard professor. I find it shocking coming from any professor.
Now, we have to cut off at one point. I just want to warn everybody here that, although I'm not a litigious person, when you make allegations of plagiarism, that's a technical
term, I agree,
which has great legal implications.
I agree.
And, you know, I can't obviously sit quietly by and,
you shouldn't.
And
okay,
accept
well, let's,
an allegation
let's look at the
of,
evidence.
Of,
let's,
of plagiarism.
Let's,
all right,
let's look at let's the just, evidence.
Who is the plagiarism
okay,
from?
Okay, let's look at the evidence. In the first two chapters of your book, you extensively reproduce all of Joan Peters's pages in her book. I read it carefully. In 1984,
show me
I'm
one
going
sentence.
To show you.
Show me one sentence.
I am going
that parallels.
To show you.
Okay.
I think I made available the charts to you.
No, I've no. You've shown me nothing.
Let's
start with that. That's
okay.
A categorical
lie. Alan,
what you're hearing now on radio is that a claim that Mr. Finkelstein made available to me certain charts.
No,
that
I
is
never
a
said
categorical
it.
Lie.
No.
Okay.
Mr. Dershowitz, I think you had about 5 minutes time. I wasn't looking at the clock. If we're going to have a civil debate, you're going to have to remain.
But it's not
going
to be a debate
going to
about
have
me.
To,
Let me
going,
be very
I'm
clear about that.
I'm not debating you. Okay. I have no interest in you, Mr. Dershowitz.
Right.
None at all. I'm interested in the scholarship, and I'm interested in the facts,
so
and I'm
I.
interested in your book. Now, in 1984, one Joan Peters published a book called From Time Immemorial. The book was universally recognized by serious scholars to be a fraud. Without wanting to toot my own horn, I'm widely recognized as the person who exposed the fraud. I know that book inside out. I read it at least four times, and I went through all 1,854 footnotes. I started to read your book, Mr. Dershowitz. I then came to chapter 1, footnotes 10, footnote 11, footnote 12, footnote 13, footnote 14, footnote 15, footnote 16. All of the quotes are from Joan Peters. They are so from Joan Peters that you have a long quote here from Mark Twain on pages 23 to 24.
Mm-hmm.
I turn to Joan Peters, page 159 to 60. The identical quote from Twain with the ellipses
is the Twain quote wrong?
With the ellipses,
is the Twain quote
let me finish,
wrong?
Sir.
No, but the key
with
is
the ellipses in the same places. The identical quote from Twain with the ellipses in the same places.
It's been widely
then,
quoted, as
yeah,
you know.
Really? Now, Mr. Dershowitz.
No,
then,
what's your point? Is it,
we then
is
have
it a correct quote?
Let
is,
me finish, no, Mr. Dershowitz.
No, I want to ask
we
you a question.
Have a,
is it a direct,
well,
is it an I'm, accurate okay. quote of Twain? Did Twain say
Professor
what
Dershowitz,
I quote him as
the
saying?
Way we, the way
have
we can
to
have,
let me finish.
The way we can have a civilized
you
discussion
quote,
here is that each person will get a chance to make their point and won't be cut off. So
you have a nearly a full page quote from one William Young.
Mm-hmm.
A British consul from May 1839.
Is it an accurate
on
quote?
On page 8, I'm going to finish, sir.
Mm-hmm.
On page 18 of your book, I turn to Joan Peters, page 184, the identical quote with the ellipses. I'm holding it up for the camera. Perhaps they can see. This is the length of the quote. The
is ellipses, it an accurate quote?
The ellipses in the identical place. Last point. I'm not going to go through chapter 2 where there are 29 plagiarisms from Joan Peters.
Wait. Let's be very clear. It is not plagiarism to quote Mark Twain correctly.
Except,
that's not
except
plagiarism.
Except if you cite Mark Twain and not Joan Peters. I'm a professor, sir. I know what plagiarism is.
And plagiarism is? Well, let's hear your definition of plagiarism.
No, we're not going to get involved
now. So you're using a word, you're not going to tell us what you mean by it.
I'm going to give the documentation, and you know what? We'll let everybody else decide for themselves. Because the documentation... One last example, and I want to make it very clear. In Joan Peters's book, From Time Immemorial, she coins a phrase. The phrase is turnspeak. And she said,
she borrows it from
she
attributes it and borrows it from somebody else. It's not her own phrase.
She coins the phrase, you see, you don't know what you're talking about, and that's pretty terrible. She coined the phrase turnspeak, and she says she's using it as a play off of George Orwell, which, as all listeners know, used the phrase newspeak.
Right.
And she coined her own phrase. Turn speak. You go to Mr. Dershowitz's book, he got so confused in his massive borrowings from Joan Peters that on two occasions, I'll cite them for those who have a copy of the book, on page 57 and on page 153, he uses the phrase, quote, George Orwell's turn speak.
Mm-hmm.
Turn speak is not Orwell, Mr. Dershowitz, you're the Felix Frankfurter Chair at Harvard.
Yes.
You must know that Orwell would never use such a clunky phrase as turnspeak.
I like it. I think it's a very elegant phrase.
Well, maybe you like it.
Yeah,
and evidently, Joan Peters liked it.
Mm-hmm.
But George Orwell never heard of it, to the best of my knowledge.
We have to break for stations. We have to break for stations to identify themselves. Mm-hmm. They have 60 seconds. And when we come back, Professor Dershowitz can respond.
We're talking
to Professor Alan Dershowitz. He's author of a new book. It's called The Case for Israel, in debate with Norman Finkelstein, among his books, The Holocaust Industry and Image and Reality of the Israel-Palestine Conflict. You're listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us.
You can look at the charts.
Music from the late Frank Lowe here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. As we continue our debate on Alan Dershowitz's new book, it's called The Case for Israel. Alan Dershowitz is professor of law at Harvard Law School. In discussion with Norman Finkelstein, who teaches at DePaul University in Chicago, his books, Image and Reality of the Israel-Palestine Conflict and the Holocaust Industry. Professor Dershowitz, your response.
Well,
this very serious charge of plagiarism.
Well, it's a frivolous charge, of course. What happened was this. Of course I read the Peters book. Anybody writing a book on the Middle East would. I also read a book called The Myths and Facts, which is a book put out originally by AIPAC and then published separately and independently, and probably 30 or 40 other books which use the same quotes. They're very extensively used quotes by Mark Twain, because Mark Twain traveled to Palestine. Mark Twain's a very prominent American writer, and what he saw in Palestine is very relevant to the debate. He saw barren lands. He didn't see a Palestinian community. He saw empty roads, and he writes extremely vividly. And a scholar is entitled to read a book, as I did, of Peter's book, and to find quotes in the book and check them against the original quotes and find them to be accurate, and then do what I did. I don't know whether or not Mr. Finkelstein read footnote 31 that appears on page 246, which says, The research of French cartographer Vital Kunz are relied
no
on
Kunst,
for the conclusions.
Oh,
I may have mispronounced it. I'm sorry.
No, you misspelled it.
And then I say, see Joan Peters from Time Immemorial, Chicago, etc. And then I say, Peters' conclusions and data have been challenged. And then I quote from Said and Hutchins, I do not in any way rely on them in this book. In other words, what I did, and it's very common for scholars to do that, is I read her books, I read Mr. Finkelstein's criticism of them, and I came away with enough doubt about the conclusions that although I don't regard the Peters book in any way as a fraud, I think it was a well-intentioned effort to recreate and the very difficult to recreate events that existed in 1890 and 1900. I did find her quotes, which have been, as I said, used extensively by Facts and Myths and other publications, to be quite compelling. And she led me, I mean, I don't purport, this book and none of my writing purport, I don't purport to be an independent historian who goes back to the Middle East and reads original documents. I'm making a case. I'm doing what a lawyer would do. And what lawyers do is they find sources, they check the sources. I had a research staff that obviously checked the sources. I haven't heard a word from Mr. Finkelstein suggesting that the quote from Mark Twain is not an accurate quote. Now, if Peters had taken, had made up a quote from Mark Twain, and it hadn't existed, Mark Twain had never written it, and then somebody borrowed the quote without going to check back on whether Mark Twain had said that, obviously that would be a serious charge. I've done nothing like that. The vast majority of my book deals with current situations. In fact, I start my book by saying there has to be a statute of limitations on grievances. I don't try to base the case for Israel on the fact that Jews lived in Palestine before the birth of Jesus, or the fact that Jews were expelled from what is now Israel in 72 AD. And I argue that Palestinians can't really make the case against a two-state solution based on historic claims that go back 100 years. But in the first couple of chapters, which are quite brief, I recount, never purporting to be creative or original in the recounting, I recount what has been accepted as the traditional history. And that traditional history includes the fact that the land, particularly what is now West, what would be Western Palestine, what was the part of Palestine allocated to Israel in the 1947 division, was land that before the Jews got there in the first Aliyah, but 1880-something, in the second Aliyah in the beginning of the 20th century, was land that was coming into disuse. Now, these are controversial, by the way. There are some Palestinians who say you shouldn't trust Mark Twain. There are some Palestinians who say you shouldn't trust the various English travelers. Reasonable people could disagree about that. I quote those sources. I lay them out there for people to read so that they can evaluate the claims that Israel was established on the basis of colonialism. I make the following argument, which I'd love to hear Mr. Finkelstein rebut. You can't be a colonialist country unless another country sent people there as soldiers to take over that country. For example, France sent its settlers to Algeria. England sent its settlers to India. The Dutch and other countries sent their settlers to parts of Africa with guns to take over. What did the Jews do during the first Aliyah and the second Aliyah? They escaped from countries that were persecuting them. They escaped from Russia. They escaped from Poland. They escaped from Lithuania. They didn't come at the request of those countries. If you claim people were colonialists, you have to say on whose behalf they were working. The Jews who came there weren't working on behalf of Russia. They weren't working on behalf of Poland. They weren't Lithuania. They came as refugees, much like American Jews came as refugees to America. The ones who went to Palestine went with rakes and hoes to try to build a land, to try to join collectively with the local population. They did, in fact, improve the land. As the result of work projects in Western Palestine, many Arabs from Eastern Palestine moved there. I cite statistics. Peter cites the same statistics, in fact, showing that in various kibbutzim, Rishon LeZion and others, the fact that 100, I don't remember the exact numbers, Jews moved there attracted 300 or 400. You may disagree with it, but those are the data that I presented, and we can reasonably disagree with that.
Okay.
Now, I just want to make one point about Mr. Mm-hmm. Finkelstein's research. I don't want to get ad hominem. I don't want to get into this debate, but for example, I do quote Mr. Finkelstein at one point, I think only once in the book, and that is he makes an argument in Edward Said's collection that to judge the 1947 partition, the only fair way to do it is to look at either all of Palestine, which I don't know whether he means to include what became Jordan, Transjordan, or not, or you have to look at what became of Israel after the 1948 war. I disagree with that. What I say, respectfully, in the book, is that when you look at the fairness of the 1947 petition, you only look at the land that was allocated to the state of Israel. And in that land, Jews were clearly a majority, according to the UN census. To be sure, once the Arab nations attacked Israel, once the Palestinians attacked Israel, there was a war, and Israel secured more land, which was regularized by a ceasefire in 1949. What Mr. Finkelstein does is he counts that land and says, aha, look at how much they got, and look at the proportion of Jews and Palestinians. That's not the correct demographic to look at. So, you know, we can have reasonable arguments about this, but let's stay away from the ad hominems and get to the merits of the case.
You know, Professor Dershowitz, I'm not a professor at Harvard, but I do.
You seem to resent that.
I do teach elsewhere, and when we discuss issues like falsifying information, plagiarizing, lifting whole cloth from other books, I've never heard that called ad hominem. For a serious scholar and a serious academic, those are very fundamental issues.
But when they're false, so, they're ad hominem.
Okay, no, if they're false, then you dispute them.
But
characterize them as ad hominem seems really out of court for a professor.
No, they are ad hominem. You said I don't deserve to teach at Harvard. Pretty ad hominem to me.
Professor Dershowitz,
you raised that issue. I'll try to address it, and then we're returning to the substantive issues of your book.
First, tell me why I
should
be teaching at Harvard.
I'm going to refer to that. Okay. On page 207 of your book, you say that to deliberately misinform, miseducate, and misdirect students is a particularly nasty form of educational malpractice.
Of which I accuse
Noam Chomsky and others, I consider what you have done in the book to be a paradigmatic, a quintessential example of misinforming, miseducating, and misdirecting.
So
you go
write,
on.
Let,
allow
article,
me to finish.
Write an article.
Let him
allow
his
me
point.
To finish, sure. Mr. Dershowitz. Mm-hmm. I've been very respectful of your time. On page 213, you discuss the Holocaust fraud by Robert Faurisson. You write, quote, "There was no extensive historical research," referring to his book.
That's right.
"Instead, there was the fraudulent manufacturing of false anti-history."
That's right. And Chomsky wrote, as you know, an introduction.
Bring in Mr. Chomsky. He can defend himself. Mm-hmm. We're talking about you and your book.
Mm-hmm.
"It was the kind of deception," referring to Faurisson's book, "now let me quote clearly, for which professors are rightly fired."
I stand by
that. "Not because their views are controversial," and let me underline this again, "but because they are violating the most basic canons of historical scholarship."
Well, let me respond to that. You can compare me to Faurisson made up a
I'm
story
referring
that
to your
the Holocaust
standard.
Didn't occur.
I'm referring to your
but you
standard.
Have to understand the context.
I have no interest in Faurisson now. I'm talking about your standard.
Absolutely.
To miseducate, misinform, and misdirect, to violate the standards of historical scholarship are grounds for expulsion.
Absolutely.
So it's not an ad hominem argument. It's using your standard.
No, it's an ad hominem argument.
I'm going to interrupt here because I want to get to some of the main points of your book.
Yeah, let's try to do that.
Also, we were intrigued on watching Scarborough Country when you debated Sam Husseini, the offer that you made.
Right.
We want to just play it for a moment.
Please.
I tell you what, I will give $10,000 to the PLO in your name if you can find a historical fact in my book that you can prove to be false. I issue that challenge. I issue it to you. I issue it to the Palestinian Authority. I issue it to Noam Chomsky. I issue it to Edward Said. Every word in my book is accurate, and you can't just simply say it's false without documenting it. Tell me one thing in the book now that is false.
Okay, let's go to the book, The Case for Israel.
Can I just talk about that for one second? Yes. And let me tell you what he came up with. This is really fascinating if you show the rest of the clip. He came up, he said on television, I saw a photograph, or I remember, or said a videotape, of Israeli soldiers aiming their guns at that, whatever, 12-year-old boy who was caught in the crossfire and killed. And I actually upped the offer to $25,000 if he could produce a photograph or if he could produce proof that he had seen that. Why was I so confident? Because German television did a very thorough study of that one particular incident. Let's just spend 1 minute on that incident. What happened is when that child was killed in his father's arms, the nation of Israel went into almost universal mourning. It was as if they were sitting Shiva on one of their own children. A child had died, and it looked as if possibly an Israeli soldier might have shot him. When you contrast that to how Palestinians respond to a child dying in Israel from terrorism, dancing in the streets, it's a very striking comparison. Then German television did a study, and they found out that the Israeli soldiers were positioned in a way that it was physically impossible for the bullet from an Israeli soldier to have hit that Palestinian child, and it was virtually certain that the bullet had come from a Palestinian gun. In my view, that's not particularly relevant. When a child is caught in a crossfire, it's a tragic death resulting from the crossfire. Which bullet actually hit him was not relevant. But that was the answer that he came up with.
Norman Finkelstein.
Well, first of all, I want to clarify the monetary issue. Is it now $25,000?
It's $25,000 on that issue.
Oh, just on the issue. In general, and, right. it's $10,000.
And let me be very clear what I said.
I heard it. We just saw it on the tape.
Let me be very clear.
I think it's
then,
clear.
Then,
it was
I then
the
made
tape.
It very clear. I said afterward, a material willful distortion of fact.
Professor Dershowitz, it's
make,
on tape.
When
we
you
just
make,
saw it.
But we're not talking about a spelling mistake.
Oh, no. I'm not
We're not talking about a minor mistake and a footnote.
Far be it for me to be so trivial.
We're talking about a serious material. Willful
Let's talk
mistake
about,
of fact that
okay,
I deliberately
serious,
engaged in.
Okay. Serious material
yes,
facts.
Yes, right.
Let's start. Number one, I'm going to first deal with just concrete facts which are not particularly controversial, which can easily be confirmed. on page 80 of your book, you write that according to Benny Morris, between April and June.
Benny Morris being an Israeli
historian. I have a copy of his book here, which
right.
I'll hold up.
Right.
2,000 to 3,000 Palestinians were made refugees during the second stage of the flight.
Mm-hmm.
Here is the book in front of you.
Yeah.
Page 256. Can you read what the sentence says?
Well, let me read you what I say in my mm-hmm. book. In some areas, Arab commanders.
Please
I'm quoting
don't read
from
the
Morris.
Whole paragraph.
No. I'm just reading. In some, let me put the context. Chomsky says that he says. Morris does not believe that any Arab leaders told the Palestinians to leave. Mm-hmm. And I say, in some areas, I quote from Morris, in some areas, Arab commanders ordered the villages to evacuate to clear the ground for military purposes to prevent surrender. Mm-hmm. More than half a dozen villages, etc., were mm-hmm. abandoned during these months as a result of such orders. Elsewhere in East Jerusalem and in many villages around the country, the Arab commanders ordered women, old people, and children to be sent away out of harm's way. Indeed, psychological preparation for the removal of the dependents had begun in 47-48, when the Arab High Command and the Arab League had periodically endorsed such a move in contemplating the future of Palestine. And I say, therefore, Chomsky is simply wrong when he says that there's no evidence. And he says, again, at another point, nobody today believes that any of the refugees were told to leave. Mm-hmm. And so I dispute that by quoting Morris
right.
himself.
You seem to have an obsession with Mr. Chomsky, but he's not here. I'm here. Let's look at the next
Actually,
sentence.
I thought I was going to be debating
okay,
Chomsky today.
Let's look at the next
I was surprised
sentence, please, Mr. Dershowitz.
Have you be here
this
today.
Is serious.
Right. I agree with you.
Read the next sentence. Morris estimates, in your book, I have it right in front of me,
right.
the next sentence.
Morris estimates that between 2,000 and 3,000 Arabs fled their homes during this phase of the Arab-initiated fighting.
Okay, can you please read what Mr. Morris wrote?
Well, no, you're
please
talking about one...
Read what he wrote.
If I have the whole book, I will find for
you,
if you want to take
Norm
time...
Norm Finkelstein, can you... If
to,
you want the
3,000 people led during this phase.
Can you
in
read
fact,
the sentence?
Okay, I'm looking at page 256 of Benny Morris's book, Righteous Victims, right. A History of the Zionist-Arab Conflict.
He's referring to phase two now, the same one as you.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
And you're talking about
all
right over
together.
Here.
Yeah.
Altogether, about 200,000 to 300,000 Arabs fled their homes during the second stage of the Exodus.
The difference between 2,000 and 3,000 and 200,000 and 300,000. Now, you could check this many times, Mr. Dershowitz, but you're really going to have to pay the $10,000. And I hope you allow me to earmark it for Janine. I would like to give it to Janine.
Let's be sure what the context is of this.
We're talking context.
We're talking about a variety of
phases. This is not the OJ trial. This is not the OJ trial.
This is not at
We're not going to play
right?
a game.
Well, just
We're not playing a game now.
Is your point that you're citing that what you're saying, Norm Finkelstein, is in Alan Dershowitz's book, The Case for Israel? He says 2,000 to 3,000,
and it's 2,000 to 300,000.
Your response to that?
I argue that 700,000 Arabs.
Don't change the subject,
that's
Mr.
Not
Dershowitz.
The changing the subject.
We're
I
talking
argue
about
that
phase two,
700,000 Arabs.
Please don't play this game.
Obviously. The phrase 2,000 to 3,000 Arabs refers either to a sub phase or is a typographical error.
This is why lawyers have
whole,
a bad reputation. Because you're playing a game now. I've read the book twice. In
but
fact,
do I ever dispute that 700? Do I ever dispute
fact,
that hundreds of thousands?
Mr. Dershowitz, in
of
fact, I've read
left.
The book six times because I read Joan Peters four times. So if you add the four times to Joan
does
Peters,
she make this point?
With the
By
two
the way,
for you, it's six
does
times.
Does she make this point?
No.
Of course she doesn't make this point. Now,
let's go to the other.
I'm going to interrupt for a second. I'm going
to
interrupt because stations have to make their point, which is they have to identify.
So
they have to identify themselves. We'll come back. And if you can stay with us for the show, we will continue this discussion. And our next guest, we'll ask him to wait, and we will do an interview after the program. I think this is too important. We're talking to Alan Dershowitz. His new book is called The Case for Israel. He is debating Norm Finkelstein, his books, The Holocaust Industry and Image and Reality of the Israel-Palestine Conflict. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! That's the late Frank Lowe on saxophone. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're talking with Professor Alan Dershowitz. His new book is called The Case for Israel. Mario Cuomo writes on the back of it, Alan Dershowitz's detailed and penetrating analysis of the issues that fuel the continuing war in Israel should be read by everyone. Norman Finkelstein's book, The Holocaust Industry, has a recommendation on the back by Raoul Hilberg, who is the leading Holocaust historian in this country. And he says, when I read Finkelstein's book, at the time of its appearance, I was in the middle of my own investigations. I came to the conclusion he was on the right track. I refer now to the part of the book that deals with the claims against Swiss banks, and I'm jumping ahead. He says, I am by no means the only one who in the coming months or years will totally agree with Finkelstein's breakthrough. Okay.
So let me focus on the 2000 or 3,000. This is such an obvious point when you think about it for a second. What is the context I'm arguing? I'm arguing that lots and lots of Arabs, in contradistinction to what Chomsky said, were told to leave by their Arab commanders. Obviously, it's in the interest of that argument to maximize the number who would leave. only an idiot would deliberately minimize the number who's leave.
Let's refrain from ad hominem attacks.
No, I'm talking about myself.
Okay.
I'm talking about myself now. Okay. I would have been an idiot had I used 2,000 when the actual number was 200 to 300. If you wanted to make an accusation, you would say, instead of saying 200 to 300, he said 400 to 500,000. Remember the argument. The argument is I'm making is that lots of the Palestinian refugees who left, left as the result of orders from their command, from their leaders during this period of time. So my incentive, if we take Mr. Finkelstein, would be to exaggerate the number. Now he accuses me of reducing the number by a hundredfold. There are only two possible explanations for that. Why would anyone make a factual error that would hurt their position?
Mr. Dershowitz, with all due respect, I cannot understand for the life of me why someone with your reputation and with your accomplishments would cobble together a fraud. That, to me, is the most perplexing question.
Let me ask you a direct question.
Let me just say something. We only have 10 minutes. We want to go to content.
I do, but I want to ask one direct question. Am I right or am I wrong that it would serve the interest of my argument to overstate rather than understate that figure?
There are no arguments in your book. Your book is a collection of fraud. Falsification.
Let me give you the argument. Let me set out the argument. So this is an answer on the merits. Here's the argument.
We're going to close both mics.
We're closing both microphones, okay? We're going to go through this in a civilized way over the next 10 minutes. You have laid out a challenge, Professor Dershowitz, on Scarborough Country, the program on MSNBC. You said if anyone can find a factual error in the book, we're not talking spelling errors, that you will give $10,000.
Yes, as I said, I'm prepared to do that.
Now I'm going to interrupt. Right? This is a major challenge.
It is.
You've put it out on television. Norman Finkelstein, you have laid out one error. Whoever's interest it served, you did respond.
No, you said
2,000 to 3,000, quoting Benny, citing Benny Morris, the Israeli historian. In fact, he said 2,000 to 300,000 Arabs.
Let me make the point that I do make an argument. Here's the argument I make. I make the argument that the issue is a complex one of the refugees, and that, in fact, many of the refugees of the 700,000.
But you're citing Benny Morris.
Of course, he made a different point than you did. He made a point that strengthens my argument.
But it's wrong in your book. Whether or not it serves your argument.
Let me be very clear. I do make an argument. My argument is a very serious one. My argument is that many of the Palestinians were told to leave by their commanders. If in fact 200,000 were told to leave instead of 2,000, that strengthens my argument considerably. That is an argument that I make. If the book says 2,000 to 3,000, there are only two explanations. Either it is a typographical error, or I have to check the book, obviously. I was referring to a smaller phase, but it would be ridiculous for anybody to understate when the purpose would be to overstate.
Okay, this is the kind of error anybody could make. Let's leave that and go to another point.
What I'm going to do for the interest of time and trying to be respectful of Professor Dershowitz is I'll simply quote your statements in the book one after another slowly. And you can simply stop me and say, I can prove that or I have the evidence.
Sure.
Okay?
Right.
Simple. Page 206, you write, Israel is the only country in the Middle East to have abolished any kind of torture in fact as well as in law.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Let's start with that one.
Yeah.
The Israeli Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories has a website, and I follow it quite closely.
So do I.
I went to the website and I checked under the heading for torture. I'll ask again Amy Goodman rather than myself to simply read the first sentence for the latest issue of B'Tselem and if she wants to continue down.
It's called B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories.
Please keep in mind, he said, Mr. Dershowitz said, in fact as well as in law. Please.
The first headline, it says torture. Interrogation by torture and absolutely prohibited by Israeli and international law.
Right.
Despite this, Israeli security forces breach the prohibition and torture Palestinians during
interrogation. Well, I don't agree with that. I mean, we have a reasonable dispute about that. What Israel does and what Israel did until 1999 was what the United States is now doing in Guantanamo. That is, they put people in uncomfortable shabak positions. They put hoods over their head, often foul-smelling hoods. They play loud music. There's a cover story in the Atlantic Monthly this month, which talks about rough interrogation techniques, and it describes what the United States is doing, and it says that Israel used to do that. There's some possibility it continues to do it. That's simply not the kind of torture that international law prohibits. And in fact, my point is, in Jordan, torture is routine. In Egypt, it's routine.
Definitely.
The Israeli Supreme Court took an extraordinarily courageous decision in 1999. I commend everybody to read it. It's online. In which Justice Aaron Barak said that as a democracy, we must fight terrorism with one hand tied behind our back. But in the end, we have the upper hand because we comply with the rule of law. Israel is to be commended for its attempt to regulate and control the torture of ticking bomb terrorists.
You stand by your
statement
that they do not
without any question, and that the Supreme Court has abolished it. And if anybody were to engage in an act that constituted torture, they would be in contempt.
Mr. Dershowitz.
Yes. And I'm right,
does,
and you're wrong.
Jordan,
6 minutes.
No, I am simply right.
Less
and you're
than 6 minutes
this.
To go.
Amnesty International, who I know you think is an untrustworthy source, Human Rights Watch, Beth Selim, they all reach the same conclusion.
And they're wrong.
Israel still continues to practice torture. Well, you can say they're wrong, but let's be clear.
Describe what Israel does. What do you define as torture?
I'm not an expert in the topic.
You're making an accusation.
I don't make the accusation, Mr. Dershowitz. You're confusing things. I go to the mainstream, respected human rights organizations, and I look at what they say.
Let me talk about Amnesty.
And they apply the international standard.
You
have a number of points here.
Okay,
we have 5 minutes to go.
I need to respond
to
this.
You did respond.
No, I didn't respond to this.
I
need to respond to Amnesty.
You have 30 seconds to respond.
Okay,
Amnesty International. Amnesty International recently said that Aharon Barak should not receive an international prize because he doesn't believe in human rights. He is one of the greatest advocates of human rights. They also, Amnesty also, on
Alan
its website,
let me ask you a question. I'm going to interrupt for a second because you're on another point.
Right.
Beth Selim. You just think Beth Selim is wrong.
No, Beth Selim is wrong.
Okay, Norman Finkelstein, next
because
point.
Because they define torture in a way that would include what the United States is doing.
We have 4 minutes to go.
Debate.
4 minutes to the end of
number
the program.
Number two, you write on page 126. Mm-hmm. There is no evidence that Israeli soldiers deliberately killed even a single civilian in Jenin.
Absolutely.
Now, Mr. Dershowitz, I looked carefully at your book.
Mm-hmm.
You don't like Amnesty International.
I'm a member
you
of
don't
it.
Like,
I'm a member
I know,
of Amnesty
but on the question of Israel.
I'm a contributor to Amnesty
Israel.
International. I like Amnesty
okay,
on Israel in a great many instances, but I disagree with some of its conclusions.
And you don't particularly like Beth Selim.
I do like Beth Selim.
Okay.
If I were an Israeli, I'd belong
Mr.
to Beth Selim. So don't
but,
characterize
okay,
my views.
Mr.
You don't know my views.
I read your book, or the book you purport to have written.
Right. Now you're claiming somebody else wrote it.
I hope so. For your sake, I truly hope you did not write that book.
I proudly wrote it.
I think the honorable thing for you to do would be to say, I didn't write the book. I had no time to read it. I'm sorry.
I wrote every word.
That
of it,
would be the honorable
and
thing.
I urge. I have
okay,
my
you
hands
made
drafts,
the point about Jenin and whether
okay,
an Israeli soldier.
Right. No, wait,
whether
I want to quote.
Deliberately
quote,
shot
okay,
a civilian.
Let's quote Human Rights Watch.
Yes.
They put out an extensive report on Jenin. Now, Human Rights Watch, you nowhere in your book mention. Nowhere. Let's see what Human Rights Watch concluded on Jenin. Quote, there's prima facie evidence that Israel committed, quote, war crimes in Jenin. Further, quote, and I want everyone to listen carefully, many of the civilian killings documented by Human Rights Watch amounted to unlawful or willful killings by the IDF. please listen to the words.
I'm listening to the words, and I deal with this very directly in my book.
And then Human Rights Watch copiously documents multiple cases of willful killings by Israel. Okay. What did Mr. Dershowitz write?
Not a single case in Jenin, but let me tell you why I make my point. I make my point because there is absolutely no incentive for the United States or for Israel or for any other democracy ever willfully to kill an innocent civilian. Every time an innocent civilian is killed, it hurts Israel. It hurts it domestically.
Let me finish my point.
It hurts it internationally. Now, every country engaged in urban guerrilla warfare will inadvertently kill civilians. But the very idea that an Israeli soldier who are trained in the idea of the holiness of arms, who get better training about avoiding civilians,
who are punished for killing civilians, let Norman Finkelstein read a response. You're making the point that in general you wouldn't think they would. Mr. Dershowitz gave a very lovely bar mitzvah speech. Now let's read what Human Rights Watch wrote. Quote, among the civilian deaths were those of Kamu Zigir, listen carefully, a 57-year-old wheelchair-bound man who was shot and run over by a tank on a major road outside the camp on April 10, even though he had a white flag attached to his wheelchair. That sounds pretty deliberate to me,
Mr. Hirsch. If it's true,
and
the Israeli
the whole world is lying. Only Joan Peters tells the truth.
Wait. First of all, Joan Peters has never written about this issue. This issue is one where, of course, not only the Israeli military, but the United States has investigated Jenin. The United Nations has investigated Jenin.
Did Human Rights Watch make up that example?
No, that was an example. They were given it to them by a source, and it was disputed.
You're shaming your institution.
Let me make it very clear, I don't speak on behalf of Harvard, not a single one.
Did Human Rights Watch make that up?
No,
but Did Human Rights Watch make it up?
Human Rights Watch attributes
it. Did it make it up? Can I make up that example?
Can I finish my point?
All right, on that note, we're wrapping up the program.
What happens is Human Rights quotes people who...
Professor Dershowitz, let me ask this question. Yes. Did you investigate the Human Rights Watch report?
Of course I did, and I read it.
And you found that to be incredible.
I found that to be incorrect. Not only that, the United States government has found that to be incorrect.
We have to wrap up the show. I want to thank you both for being with us. Alan Dershowitz, The Case for Israel, Norman Finkelstein, The Holocaust Industry. You decide. Our website, www.democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.